Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin. My guest today is Tori Olson, the Director of Christian Commitments at World Vision, a religiously based humanitarian assistance organization that has a global outreach across at least 100 nations and is headquartered right close to me in Federal Way, Washington. Tori has been with World Vision since 1989 and has been out in the field for 15 of those years, primarily in West Africa. He has a master's degree in international development from Michigan State University and an MDiv from the Denver Seminary. And he is currently working on a PhD in communications. But he has also received an education from the School of Hard Knocks, learning such things as how to survive malaria, being abducted by rebels in the Civil War, and being shot at. All of this stuff we'll be talking about. So, Tori, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony. Great to be with you this morning.
Now, my listeners should know that for most of my interviews that I conduct, especially those involving scholarly researchers, I prepare a set of questions that I share with the guests ahead of time. This helps to guide us along in our discussion. Oftentimes, the conversations take on a life of their own, depending on what the guest says and what may pop into my mind during the discussion. But today, though, we're going to engage in a more free-flowing conversation. While I do have a couple of topic areas that I want to address with Tori, this is more of my opportunity just to freely chat with somebody who works for an interesting organization and has led an absolutely fascinating life. So I'm not sure exactly where the conversation is going to go. As you might be aware of, I am always fascinated by the background history of all of my guests and will ask a few biographical questions along the way, and that will be a big part of our chat. So I firmly believe that you need to dig into somebody's biographical details to understand what they're actually talking about. So let's go ahead and do that. You ready?
Great.
All right, I want to start off with some organizational issues with you at first, specifically with the organization World Vision, which you've been with for quite a while. Some of the folks out there may have heard of this organization. You may have seen it in places on ads on late night television, usually National Geographic or History Channel. I've seen them there. You don't have any Super Bowl ads yet, correct?
Not yet.
Not yet. Okay. So tell us a little bit about World Vision. What is it? Where is it started? What does it do?
Well, World Vision was started in 1950 by a U.S. pastor communicator by the name of Bob Pierce. So it's got 64 years of history right now, and we work in about 100 countries around the world in relief and development, and then advocacy. So our advocacy work is just as important, because oftentimes we're looking at the structural issues and the root causes of poverty that very much are justice issues. So over the years and decades, World Vision has expanded. Almost half of our work, or approximately half of our work, is in Africa at this time, but we're in many of the Latin American and Asian, Middle Eastern countries, and most of the world's hotspots. Afghanistan, these days, Sierra Leone. In fact, I've got a project mobilizing faith-based leaders into the Sierra Leone epicenter of Ebola right now. So almost wherever the hotspots are, northern Syria, Iraq, these other places, World Vision is there with relief and then sometimes later on development work.
I want to come back and talk about some of those examples, such as the Ebola initiative that you're working on. You mentioned that it's an advocacy organization. Now, what does that mean? And also, did it start out that way in 1950? Was this we're going to be an advocacy organization, or has that developed that way in time?
Yeah, that's a great question, Tony. Actually, advocacy has been layered in over the years. I think we started perhaps a bit simplistically, as many other organizations, thinking that as we simply did good development work, as we did good relief work, that would resolve the issues. But of course, we found out that poverty is very complex. And because of that, we realized that the structural issues needed to be addressed, sometimes at the community level, sometimes at the family, gender level. And so we have program models in which we're helping husbands and wives to look much more closely at themselves and marriage and, of course, the justice issues that are so often typical, not just in developing countries, but even in more developed countries between men and women. Well, the same is true at community levels and then national levels. It's for that reason that we have a observer presence at the United Nations in New York, and we have 10 of our staff working with members of Congress on Capitol Hill, dealing with very important issues that affect poverty, issues such as landmines and sex trafficking, issues such as boy soldiers and blood diamonds, funding for AIDS and HIV work in the field. These are justice structural advocacy issues that so much affect the work that we're doing thousands of miles away.
So you seem to have a presence in a lot of places, not only at the ground level that we see maybe on the commercial helping feed children, and that's the typical image we have of humanitarian organizations, but also at the United Nations, where you have people probably in an office meeting with people saying, hey, these are the issues we're concerned about. This is where we think we can help. Where do you think you can help? How big is the organization then? I mean, if you got many people around there, I mean, how many employees and how many volunteers? I'm sure you have a number of volunteers as well.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. Well, there are between 45 and 50,000 staff that we have in almost 100 countries of the world. Volunteers, oh, there would be several hundred thousand that would be out there, most of them living in their own communities. So they would be people who would be child monitors, child sponsor supervisors. One of our funding means is that of child sponsorship. That would be the one that you would have seen perhaps on late night television, but that's only a part of the funding streams that we have, others being major government grants or private or corporations or foundations. All of these are significant.
So what roughly is the budget that you're operating with? I mean, 50,000 employees and worldwide presence, that's got to be more than, you know, $100,000. How big is a budget do you have there?
Well, worldwide, from all of our support entities, it's north of $2 billion a year.
Wow. And you said a lot of that comes from grants, donation. Do you get donations?
We do indeed. So much of it would come from our private child sponsors that we would have not only here, but in Canada and Australia, New Zealand, many of the European countries. Each of these would have child sponsorship programs where one donor would sponsor one or more children. It's a great means of having a relationship with a child, and my wife and I are child sponsors for a number of kids. But beyond that, there are government grants, European Union, U.S. Agency for International Development, and other major governments around the world will support World Vision through their own auspices and their own resources for relief and development. And then, of course, there are the major foundations. There's the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And there are many corporations, several hundred, that have or are contributing to World Vision through what we call gifts in kind. Now, for example, do any of us have our deworming pill here this morning, Tony?
I don't, but I did have to take the dog to the vet. So we know all about deworming, but no, what is this deworming pill you talk of?
Well, for most of us here in North America, that's just kind of a funny question. And yet, we receive tens of millions of dollars worth of deworming pills, and that's a very big deal. Because in developing countries, that little deworming pill taken once every 6 months can make the difference between poor health and sustained much better health for hundreds of thousands of little boys and girls. And that would be a gift in kind. That would come from a pharmaceutical manufacturer. And so there are many kinds of things, whether they are books or toys or clothes or shoes or pharmaceuticals that we receive that we're able to distribute. And these are new. They are not used. They are those with a short shelf life, of course. And we use them only according to very strict policies. But they are part of the layered in resources that are used where appropriate in the field, as our field directors say, we could use those.
Yeah, I know we chuckled a little bit about the deworming pills, and here in the United States, we tend to think about that for our canine companions, but in reality, it's just something very, a small, minor thing for us becomes a big, huge health issue that has dramatic impacts in the developing world, and that's one of the things that you do. I know that World Vision is a faith-based organization. As I drove out here to your headquarters in Federal Way, you have a cross on the sign that you can see. Is it a missionary organization?
We typically don't use the word missionary, but I will say, Tony, that we are unabashedly a Christian organization, and our mission is to follow our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ in working with the poor, seeking justice, and bearing witness to the good news of Jesus Christ. We do this in no less than six different ways: relief, development, advocacy being the primary ways. So our motivation is to follow Jesus Christ, but of course we are not a proselytizing organization and never have been. So any who would have those old-fashioned images of, what shall we call them, rice Christians, that is exactly the opposite. In fact, World Vision was a original signatory to the Red Cross Code of Conduct. What does that mean? That means that in that Red Cross Code of Conduct, it is clear that there will be no inducement, no incentives, no manipulation, either to change one's faith or to change from one part of a faith to another part. And that's very clear. That is not our desire. We work with many Hindus, Buddhists, Muslims, as well as Christians. In fact, my 15 years in West Africa were spent in entirely Muslim areas. And I found myself deeply loving Muslim people and have spent those years there. In fact, my wife's and my oldest child is named Muhammad, or Mo, as we call him. We adopted him when he was a little kid that didn't seem to have much of a future, and his family came to us and said, would you please adopt him? His father had died, others in his family had died, and we were so pleased to be able to take him in. And he's doing wonderfully well, 27 years of age right now, and well through college. And in fact, he's buying a house this week, which we're thrilled about.
Well, fantastic. That's another success story just at the grassroots level, which is always inspirational. You mentioned that you are a Christian-based organization. Is it affiliated with any specific denomination? Is there a tendency toward evangelical Protestantism or any specific denomination? Are you proudly ecumenical?
We certainly are ecumenical. Across the world, in almost all of our Middle East and Eastern European countries, the vast majority of our staff there would be Orthodox. Other places of the world, Latin America, many, of course, are Roman Catholic. Other places, they would come from Pentecostal backgrounds or mainline backgrounds, or in other cases, predominantly evangelical backgrounds. So our theme is to follow our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, and these other, shall we call them, denominational distinctives are so secondary that they're really almost irrelevant.
Do you have members of other faith traditions, so Judaism, Islam, Hinduism, working with the organization directly, or are they just affiliates?
Absolutely. In Afghanistan, where I was not too long ago, of our 400 staff, six would be expatriates, and they would be Christians. The others, well, they would all be Muslims, because, of course, it is illegal to be other than a Muslim. And that would be the context and the situation in many other places. The Islamic Republic of Mauritania, where I was, other countries like that, where the vast majority, if not all of the people officially are Muslims, of course, we will have Muslims there. But we maintain that our senior leadership will be Christians. So the national director and at least a couple of the others who would be the expatriates. We believe it's important to have a Christian presence, and yet we would not be able to work in these places, and we want to be able to have these Muslims and Hindus and Buddhists that probably don't make up more than 5 or 10% of World Vision's workforce internationally, but they are very important members of our big team.
Now, we mentioned earlier that you have presence in about 100 nations around the world, and that covers a, a big swath of the world. Are there certain areas that are favored more than others? I mean, I guess I was surprised to hear that you're in Afghanistan. That's a tough country. It's going through a lot of conflict right now. Are there places that you go that are easier to get into and you favor those? Or do you look for the hard nuts to crack and go for those?
We do look for the hard nuts to crack. My boss, based in Washington, D.C., just got back a couple of days ago from northern Iraq and Syria. And we are ramping up our work there. We have 140 staff in a relief effort. This is hostile territory for those of us who are outsiders. And yet we feel compelled to be in those most difficult places. Our faith compels us to be there because we don't have to listen to the news very much to see the incredible need, the fear, the now millions of people. In reality, between 8 and 9 million displaced people, internally displaced people, or refugees from that Syrian and Iraqi crisis. Well, it's not easy, but that's where we need to be. That's where we want to be. We choose to be there.
And in terms of choosing to be at different places, do you have set areas that you have a long-term presence in? And are there other places that you act as what you might call a rapid deployment force? You see on the news, whoa, things are really bad in northern Iraq. The Kurds are in desperate need. Let's send a group out there right away. How do you manage that?
Yeah, that's a great question. The reality is that many of our long-term development programs have started as we have sent out our Global Rapid Response Team, our GRRT. And these are folks that rapidly do deploy, and oftentimes soon following them would be these rapid resources, whether they are water purifications or tents, whether they are foodstuffs and supplies like Plumpy Nut or
things. What's a Plumpy Nut? Yeah, tell me about that. We talked about hard nuts to crack, but I've never heard of a Plumpy Nut.
It is a little packet that can be rapidly produced and is produced right here in the States as well as other places that's filled with a nutty-like solution that's sort of halfway between a liquid and a solid, high protein, and can be brought into these relief contexts, and they can be spilled out, and kids as well as adults can have access to these things and in short order have an important caloric intake. And oftentimes we'll do this in conjunction with other similar resources like oral rehydration, things that absolutely need to be there on the front line of a response. So we'll come in, and as we are working with government or non-government resources to respond, if it looks like there will be a long-term challenge, and if we are invited and if there are resources, then we will make the strategic decision to stay there. That's the way we have done in many, many countries.
Do you happen to have a warehouse filled with Plumpy Nuts and that's just ready to go on moment's notice? I mean, for me, just the logistics of this is absolutely fascinating, that you'll get a report from somewhere in the world that there's a conflict which is causing a disruption in food supplies, and you say, hey, we're here to help, we're on it. You might talk to the United Nations or Congress or whoever it might be in there. So is there a warehouse?
Absolutely. There are four or five warehouses around the world, one in Germany, South Asia, one in Denver, Colorado, and these are our global pre-positioning centers. So as soon as we hear that there has been an earthquake, a famine, a drought, a tsunami, we will be in contact with our staff. And usually we have staff already on the ground in these places. When the tsunami hit about 10 years ago, well, we had 5,000 staff in those frontline countries. And so within hours, we were beginning the response. And within a day or two, they were communicating to us, hey, we're going to need water purification. We're going to need these tabs, and we're going to need these tents. We're going to need these cook stoves and other supplies. And that word was communicated to our different centers, and they rolled out pallets. And onto the planes went the pallets, and in short order, the response and relief supplies arrived there, as they do in many of the world's emergencies, and we're able to respond very quickly because of these global pre-positioning centers.
For me, this is an absolutely fascinating aspect of organizations such as yours. I know in academia, we talk a lot about high-minded concepts of aid, and you have PowerPoint presentations with all this, but just the fact of setting up a warehouse to get to someplace within a day or two, or maybe even hours, is just logistically fascinating to me, and the work that your organization does is incredible in that respect. We oftentimes overlook that stuff. One of the things that we were talking about while I was setting up my equipment here for this interview was another, I guess this would be a rapid response initiative right now, that deals with an ongoing crisis that's popped up in the news this past few months, and that's with the issue of Ebola. Tell our listeners what's happening out there in West Africa and how World Vision is part of the response.
Yeah. Well, in Sierra Leone, as in many of the other frontline countries there, World Vision has had a response for a long time. World Vision has been in many of the West African countries. In fact, that's where I spent 15 years. Well, as any of us who have not been living under a rock for the last month or two know, the Ebola crisis is now front news on almost every channel and medium. And there in Sierra Leone, with our several hundred staff, they have responded as they're working with the World Health Organization, the National Ministry of Health. But something that I think is a distinctive of World Vision, and we see it in country after country, is the mobilization of faith-based organizations. Now, what does that mean? That means, in short, that as we have developed a what we call a channels of hope, or channels of hope even for Ebola response, we work with our medical and faith response leaders as we will bring together the pastors, the priests, and the imams and train them in the key response initiatives to Ebola. And what we'll do is we'll bring them together, have some fascinating pictures these last few days of pastors being in mosques. That has never happened in the history, perhaps, of Sierra Leone, where you will have faith leaders from one faith communicating important life-giving health messages to people of another faith. Not only is the good message about using chlorine and washing hands and not touching certain kinds of people and behaving appropriately getting through, but almost as important, so is the breaking down of the distinctions, breaking down of the barriers and the suspicions between, in this case, Christians and Muslims. We see this in country after country as we will use films or as we will use program models that bring Muslims and Christians together. And Tony, I'm sure that as you have traveled and worked around the world, you've seen the same that I have, and that is that so much of our media and our press, they have obviously as their goal to make money. We understand that, but so often the important stories, the backstories, the stories of progress and development and of relief response, of people working together, Muslims and Christians making progress, those are not the stories that get out there, and yet that's such an important part of the story, and it's what we're involved in as we're working with Muslims and Hindus and Buddhists, as well as Christians of all different backgrounds around the world. And it's been a great pleasure as the Director of Christian Witness to be resourcing and funding and working with our 200-some, what we call Christian Commitments staff, as they are mobilizing imams and mosques and priests and people from various different backgrounds to address some of the critical social issues that are existing in their context.
For me, this is absolutely fascinating, and you're right that these are the stories that are not told. If you ask folks today, how are Christian-Muslim relations in the world, they immediately would flash an image of what's happening in Syria. And they say, well, it can't be good. But here's a crisis that is affecting everybody, irrespective of their faith tradition, and you're responding in ways that are actually bringing these communities together. And it's a wonderful story. I'm glad we're having a chance to mention it. One of the questions that popped into my mind when we were talking about this is how World Vision can get into these faith communities Does it happen faster than they can get through governments? Because one of the things you know about many developing nations that working through governments can be very difficult. And so you talked about rapid response teams in terms of getting plumpy nuts to people, but there must be a rapid response team that brings people together at the local grassroots level.
Well, it's a very interesting phenomenon as I've looked at this thing over 25 years. 25 years ago, by leaders and donors in the West, those of us who came from faith communities were highly suspect. But there's been a massive sea change over the last 10 or 15 years. Part of it has had to do with the research that USAID or AusAid or UNICEF has done. Some of it's had to do with both the Bush and the Obama administration's faith-based and community initiatives. And basically what we're seeing here is that which we in faith-based relief and development organizations have noticed across the years, and that is that so many of the critical questions are ones that need the sustainable community-based organizations led by faith leaders. And they are the ones that were there first. They're the ones that have the respect and authority in the communities. They're the ones that can deal with such important issues as sexuality and violence and gender. These are the critical justice issues of development that are out there. And it's not the government, and it's not the faith-based experts that come from the outside, like you and me, that would be able to speak to that. But the local imams, the local pastors, the local priests, they can. And they will be there long after World Vision or other international groups roll out. So as we come in, we find that even though we are a Christian organization, there is a high level of trust in World Vision because we are trusted, and this is interesting, this is perhaps counterintuitive, but we're trusted by Muslims and Hindus and Buddhists more than people who are secular in general, because we are clear that we are not proselytizing, but we do have a faith and we're motivated by our faith. That is something that we in the North may not identify, may not understand. Reality here is that even discussions of religion and politics tend to be toxic. Well, that's not the case. That's a place where you start, and in so many of these developing countries. And so we use that as an opportunity to build bridges, even with people of very different faiths.
And that's very interesting in talking about how you leverage local knowledge of the areas, and then the trust aspect is incredibly important, and it's a really neat story that does need to be told. I want to ask you about your title. You mentioned that you are the Director of Christian Witness, and I think I mentioned in the biography that I gave at the beginning of the interview that you were the Director of Christian Commitments. I don't know if you've changed your name on that or if I misplaced it when I first said it, but what does that mean? What do you do on a daily basis as a Director of Christian Witness?
Yeah, well, really there are three things that we do, and I get to work with a wonderful team as we are mobilizing resources with World Vision in order to support our staff in the better part of 100 countries of the world in about 50 projects. And what are those three things? Well, the first is that we will train and support our staff. I mentioned there are 45,000 or north of that. And many of them are Christian staff, but working in these Muslim, Hindu, Buddhist contexts, and they don't have the resources that they need to understand how do we really work in appropriate justice responses or in appropriate relief resources and contexts. And so the first focus is our staff. The second is mobilizing churches and faith-based organizations. Now, we talked about that a few minutes ago, but there are some people who are church scholars who would say that there are perhaps between 8 and 9 million churches on the face of the earth. Well, here's a question that many in the development world are asking. Why would we not mobilize the world's largest network of highly motivated volunteers to help us with our development initiatives relating to gender or sexual violence or any of these other very important initiatives if they are there and can be trained and they want to help their own communities. And so that's what we're working on. And the third has to do with children. We want to support children in their own training. And again, never do we proselytize, but we do want them to be in contexts of freedom so that they can experience the very best lives that they can. Those are the things that we're working on day in and day out with project proposals and with the raising resources and then, of course, reporting back to donors once we finish a program or reporting cycle.
That second thing that you do as the director of mobilizing churches and other faith-based organizations really resonates with me, because in the scholarly community, there's a lot of discussion about new social movements, and NGOs has been a big buzz term for the past 10 or 15 years, and a lot of people are studying these new emerging secular social movements. And my colleagues would always come up to me, have you heard about these? And I would just kind of chuckle and say, I know some old social movements that have been around for thousands of years, and maybe we should learn a few things from them as well. And it's interesting to see that more and more nations around the world, governments and also local communities, are opening up to saying, yeah, these organizations, volunteer organizations, are really useful in just leveraging everyday assistance for individuals.
Absolutely. I mean, they've been there, they will be there, they have credibility, they are leaders, they represent the people themselves, they have the local knowledge and the local languages. Again, why would we not work with those good-hearted people to help them do what they know they already need to do in their own communities?
I want to now shift the discussion to a bit about your history. We just mentioned that you're the director of Christian Witness, and I'm always fascinated about how people get to the place that they are now. I mean, it couldn't have been the thing that when you were 7 years old, somebody asked you, what do you want to grow up to be? And you said, I want to be the director of Christian Witness at a large faith-based assistance organization. How did you get from where you were growing up to where you are today? Did you grow up in a religious household? Were you parents or a child of parents who were missionaries? What's the story there?
Yeah, right. Well, my father indeed was a pastor, but I, like a lot of us, I was a prodigal for a good block of years. And then during my college years, after having bumped around and experimented with a lot of different things, I came to the place where I realized, you know, really, what am I going to do with my life? I went to a conference, and I was really challenged with the fact that, boy, there are a lot of needs out there. And somehow, I feel the Lord put on my own heart the desire to work in Muslim contexts. In fact, I had a number of friends who had curiously grown up in Afghanistan. And, I got a degree in geology and then a master's degree in international development. And then I got a seminary degree and then some more work in communications, had a good number of degrees. And in the whole process, I found myself thinking, I want to help these people that are out there in the front lines. And that's been a lot of my wife's and my experience over these years, 15 years in the countries of Mali, Senegal, Mauritania, Chad, a whole lot of countries that most Americans have never heard of, but a lot of good stuff is going on.
So you said you were interested in working in a Muslim context, and actually, where did you grow up?
Assuming I did grow up, right,
Tony? Oh, well, there you go, yeah.
The Boston area.
The Boston area. Okay. Yeah. So what drew you to the Muslim world? And then also, as we move into your time in the field in West Africa, the 15 years you spent there, did you choose that area? Did that area choose you? Or did somebody else say, throw a dart at the map and you're going to be there?
Well, when I was attending this conference, I remember a man who, in fact, was the pastor of the only church in Kabul, Afghanistan. And he got up and he said, I want you to imagine something with me. I want you to imagine walking down the street and you're seeing 10 men carrying a telephone pole. And 9 of them are on one end and there's just one guy laboring under the other end. If you really want to make a difference, to which end do you go? That so resonated with me as I was thinking about food and water insecurity, about justice issues. I was so actively involved during my graduate school years with justice issues, Food for the Hungry, Amnesty International. I found myself saying, boy, these are the forgotten areas of the world, and they're not on anybody's radar screen. But I'll bet they're on God's radar screen. And somehow I just sensed that that's where I needed to be. And that was, as I continued in graduate school and studied, something that just continued to resonate. And, well, that's where I found myself. And I'm so glad that that's the way it's gone.
And let's talk about that moment that you do go out to the field. I mean, you have some very interesting stories right here of the first few months that you went to West Africa. Give us a little bit of lead up. How did you get connected to be with, I believe when you went to West Africa, you were with World Vision, correct?
Well, not the first time.
Okay.
I had gone over there briefly prior with another organization doing relief and agricultural work. And just within the first 6 months, they decided to start a civil war over there. That was in 1979 in Chad. I had just finished or was in the process of finishing my graduate work in international development at Michigan State University. And it was crazy. It was utter chaos. Barely escaped with my life. Spent the last night in the country under my bed as 800 people were killed in the city of Mundu. That was the night of March 11th, 1979, I remember it as if it was yesterday, with shots and screaming all around. And then early in the morning, before the sun even came up, we were able to get a word through the local radio there that we needed to get to the airport. And we ran to the airport just less than a kilometer away in Koutou, in the southern part of Chad. And there were two big French Transall airplanes that were waiting, and their engines were revving, and people were, of course, screaming. There was gunshots all around, and I ran, climbed onto the airplane, and there were no seats. There were just the fold-down seats from the sides of the airplane. That's the way these airplanes are, where you can run a big truck on or off from the back loader. And we took off. The plane that followed ours just a few minutes later was shot. It did not crash, but it was a compelling time, let's put it that way. And it certainly impressed me with many different things at that time, including the fact that there needed to be not only developmental changes, but changes in people's hearts. And that deeply impressed me. In fact, it was that which really sent me back to Denver Seminary. And that has put me on the course. And then during my years with World Vision, starting back in 1989, I've had a lot of other adventures. Indeed, being abducted by rebels. That was in 1992, just after Kim and I had been married. I was taken at gunpoint by rebels and whisked off many miles north into the Sahara Desert. I was sure I was going to be killed, but they just put on the brakes in my car, my Toyota Land Cruiser, dumped me out, and I walked back many, many miles across the open desert, no roads, and got back to the city of Gao in northern Mali. Well, that was in the middle of the Civil War, and I was forced to close down that project and put on temporary suspension well over 100 staff. So we were not able to continue our relief and development work for that time. But we were able to start up again in a couple of months, and there we were able, with the resources of the U.S. government, U.S. Agency for International Development, to restart the work in distributing commodities to women's centers for nutrition and nutritional education. And then our other agricultural and well drilling work. That's what we were involved in right there. And many other adventures, being shot at, traveling in military convoys, actually medevaced four times over a 15-year period, and having to medevac many of my staff. That just kind of goes with the territory. Many of us in World Vision have been through that stuff. We've spent years overseas. We have stories to tell about that.
I have to explore this a little bit more because, you know, 1979, Chad, you're hiding under your bed and hundreds of people are being killed around you, and you got to run to this C-130 transport plane that the French have, being kidnapped and dropped off in the Sahara Desert and, you know, having to walk back. What goes through your mind at this time? I mean, for a lot of people who are listening, they would probably say, including me, saying, you know what, this missionary stuff or this humanitarian assistance stuff, this ain't for me. I mean, what would bring you back? I mean, I'm just fascinated by that.
Well, it's interesting. My first response, as I was at gunpoint and hustled into the back of my own car in front of about 30 people there, my first response was one of anger. Well, maybe it was shock and disbelief, but right away it was anger. And I started to argue with these two guys who had me at gunpoint. I said, look, this was in French, of course, but I said, I'm the director of World Vision's programs here. We're distributing thousands of tons a year to the mouths of your mothers, your sisters, your children. It's all going to stop if you don't let me go. And for the second and then the third time, they pushed the pistol into my head and said, shut up or we'll kill you. And I realized, okay, these guys don't have respect, not for men or God or even their own people. And so, needless to say, I was quiet. It was interesting. It wasn't until a few days later, I guess when the adrenaline had sort of drained away, that the fear really kicked in. And I did find that as my wife and son and I went on vacation, we went and spent a number of days on the beach in Senegal, that then anybody that looked at all like those men that had taken me, I just became very fearful. So, call it post-traumatic stress disorder, call it shock. I went through probably each of the stages that anybody would who had been in those kinds of situations. And it wasn't for a good number of months that I came to the point where I said, okay, I can work in these contexts with these people without feeling that anybody who looks physically like those people will have a gun in their pocket, for example, and will take me again. But that was an issue of heart over head, or head over heart, I guess I should say. It did not happen overnight. And so I have a lot of sympathy for our many, many staff who go through these kinds of things all the time. In fact, World Vision has what we call our HEAT training. And so we send all of our key international staff who are working in conflicted context zones through this training so that they can know what to do, so that they'll make right decisions, so that they will understand these processes that I've just described of the emotional trauma that goes through our minds and hearts when we get into very difficult contexts. These are the things that we deal with.
That's the question that I was thinking about asking here is, have you had the opportunity to share your experiences with individuals who are about to go out into the field? And how do they react to that? You know, I think, you know, the idealistic 20, 21-year-old saying, I'm out here to, you know, provide water to kids and I'm going to do great things. And then you come along and say, oh, by the way, let me tell you what happened in 1979. I can imagine some of these kids go, whoa, what am I signing up for this? How do you manage that?
Well, I want to say right away, Tony, that we do not take inappropriate risks. We do everything that we possibly can to ensure that our staff do take the appropriate safety measures. We do risk assessments and mitigations. Every one of our national offices will have a very thoroughgoing plan for risk assessment and mitigation and response in case there are incidents. And we have manuals on how to handle things. All that being said, as I said some minutes ago, we do go to the hot zones. We do go to these very difficult and challenging contexts. And so these things do happen on a regular basis. And we have lost four staff in Afghanistan. We have lost 7 staff in Pakistan. I lost a staff person on my team in northern Mali. And I would say that once we have done our very best to reduce these risks and mitigate these contingencies, we realize that there is a measure of risk, and we choose to lean into that.
I want to move towards some of the things that you did. I mean, this stuff is fascinating, when just going through these difficulties, but it's not always like that. You're not always being shot at. You're doing a bunch of really neat stuff. And so in your 15 years in the field, what were some of the things you were involved in? And more importantly, did you learn over that time? And how did the process evolve from you, from being there actually starting in 1979 in West Africa and then coming back again in 1989 after doing other different things? You're with World Vision in 1989. Has there been a process of learning and feedback with the head organization saying we should do things this way or that way? How did that evolve?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, my learning, I think, has been paralleled by the organization's learning in many ways. I would say that when I started, I probably had that naive notion that we could just walk in, everybody would be well-intentioned, and if not with the flip of the wrist or a magic wand, at least in short order, we could bring about change. Well, that's not the reality. Poverty and the finding the resolutions to poverty is rocket science. It may not be technically, but sociologically, in anthropology, it really is rocket science. And so it takes time. That's why World Vision's in a place for 15 to 20 years, unlike many organizations. And I think when I started off, I figured that in a few weeks or months or years, we could just flip the switch and it would take place. One of my own experiences in northern Mali is that we started in the city of Gao, a city of 50,000 people on the Niger River, with the first sets of gardens right there. Not a complex initiative, certainly not complex to grow a wide variety of vegetables, to teach moms about nutrition, to supplement it. And yet, that was not something that people adopted very easily. And yet, as we were there working for over 10 years, we went from people not being interested, not getting those nutritive elements, those vitamins, to, as we left 10 years later, it being the case that you could hardly walk the 60 miles between Gao and another city of Ansongo to the south along the river's edge without stepping in a garden.
Wow.
In other words, people took time, but once they saw the benefits to themselves and to their kids of having nutrition, having more vitamins, having a broader diet, then it swept across their minds and across the landscape. But that did not happen overnight. And World Vision started back in the early years with many interventions that were much more short-term. Well, now we're much more long-term. So that's one of the keys to poverty. It's building relationships. It's going at the pace of the community. It's taking time. It's resolving the issues, knowing the local languages, working with the local leaders, and then helping people to say, hey, this was our idea. We see the benefit for us and for our kids. Simple lesson, maybe to you and me, and yet, boy, to put that into practice in a developmental context, it's really life-changing.
Now, we talked about some of the more terrifying moments that you've had, and we've just also talked about these gardens that sprung up over the course of a decade, which takes a lot of time, takes a lot of patience. Has there been any other experiences that, when you look back, you say, wow, that was just a moment that everything came together, and I know that I've made a huge difference?
Oh, I would say there have been a number of those contexts. Let me give you an example in Senegal, working with imams. Back in the 90s, AIDS was on everybody's headlines. HIV and AIDS, the research was ramping up. And it was during that time that we made a decision as a Christian faith-based organization to reach into the 95% of the population's religious leaders, namely working with imams. And so we asked imams, as we ourselves began to understand the health and the sociological implications, we asked the imams if they would make television messages to be put on national television speaking about how AIDS, HIV would be contracted and how it could be stopped. And in that context, what we saw was that across the national airwaves, people responded well because, oh, well, it was coming from their faith-based leaders. But it also showed to them that people of a Christian organization cared deeply for them, and that Christians and Muslims could work together amidst perhaps the most pressing and urgent physical issue of that time. That's the way we operate, and I love seeing those contexts where we're working in a counterintuitive way when we're not working in the ways that it seems are often reported on. I'll give you another example or two. We started a few years ago using a film called The Imam and the Pastor. It was actually developed about 10 years ago by another organization, but we have, with their permission and in partnership with them, used this. And it's the true story of an imam and a pastor in Jos, Nigeria, who were trying to kill one another back these 10 or 12 years ago. And as they came to the point where they realized, you know, I'm destroying the future for my kids. It doesn't make any sense to destroy the church or the mosque of the other organization, the other faith group. They said, let's meet. And they did, and they started an organization that is now working to combat violence. And they made a film, and they have been to Washington, D.C. We've had them in our offices. It's a wonderful film. Again, The Imam and the Pastor. World Vision has used this thing with national media. In Ghana, we have showed this one time on the national news, and the national government said, well, we want to show it. It's now been shown 8 times, and 10 million people have seen this film. Fairly recently, Boko Haram, that we all have heard of, an organization that is bent on killing and on dividing Christians and Muslims, they came into these areas of northern Ghana. And they said, hey, let's kill, let's loot, let's burn. And the community said, no, we have seen this film called The Imam and the Pastor. We work with World Vision, and there is no need at all to be killing and fighting. And in fact, get out of here, Boko Haram. And they were run out of town because people said, we can work together with people of other faiths. We're not going to resort to violence. We want a better future for our children, and they want the very things for their children that we want for our kids, Tony. And it's a great story, and I see this happening again and again in different contexts. I wish these stories were getting out more often because they are just as true as the bad news that we see in the media and the press. It's just that perhaps they don't sell as many papers.
Yeah, I want to follow that line of thought here for a minute and wrap around to something that we talked about at the beginning of the interview. A lot of faith-based organizations such as World Vision or CARE or others, organizations such as that, oftentimes are accused of cultural imperialism and trying to convert others and oftentimes causing conflict. You just gave us a story where that has worked in the absolute opposite direction. But how does World Vision, how do other organizations combat that impression? I mean, the media might not be helping very much because the media likes flashy stories where things explode, conflict sells newspapers. But how does World Vision try to get this message out more broadly?
Yeah, well, we certainly use our own resources. We report to donors, and we do try to communicate in various ways the wonderful stories that are going on in some of the world's conflict places. And, of course, as we are working at the United Nations, as we have a representative as an observer status there, as we're working on Capitol Hill, we try to get these stories out so that people do understand that this is the case. Does it have a CNN headline? No, it normally does not. But we do our best, and I certainly appreciate the time with you to be able to share what is such an important backstory. Let me say one other thing here. So often we, I think, either get jaundiced or we get hopeless or we sense that, boy, it's just everything is collapsing out there. It's all bad news. And yet Bill Gates wrote the foreword on a very important book, came out 2 years ago, called Getting Better, How the World is Getting Better and What We Can Do to Improve It. Basically, the Bill and Melinda Gates annual newsletter gives a short synopsis of this in about 10 pages, how so many indicators, whether it is potable water or immunization or guinea worm or education. So many of these indicators have improved drastically over the last 40 years. Well, faith-based organizations have been a part of that. And though it's not popular, perhaps, to speak of the role of faith-based organizations, the reality is that faith-based organizations have been part and parcel of this vast sea change in the developing world. I was just in Malawi 2 months ago, and I was told by our national director there that 64% of all of the schools in the country and 48% of all of the hospitals and health organizations in the country were founded by Christian faith-based organizations. Now, some people would say, religion destroys or it hurts. Really? In my experience, having been in 20 countries of Africa, so many of the schools and clinics and hospitals and immunization programs, of the malarial nets, and of the microenterprise and development programs, of the work to enhance the role of women, the efforts for child protection, these are led by faith-based organizations, and we are making a difference. And whether it makes the press headline or not, that is the backstory. That is the reality. A lot of great stuff is happening, and it is so often the people who are motivated by faith. For us, it's our faith motivated in Jesus Christ that leads us and puts us even to be willing to be in those very difficult places. And do I need to proselytize? Of course not. We do not. We covered that. But it is a quiet daily motivation every morning that I sense personally where I feel, Lord, you've blessed me so much. Let me be a blessing to somebody else. Maybe it's somebody in my workplace. Maybe it's on my street. Maybe it's all the way around the world. How can I do that? And I sense that that quiet faith that I have, my faith in Jesus Christ, is that which continues to motivate me. It has for 25 years, and I hope it will. I'm sure it will for as long as I am privileged to be a part of this organization.
Well, that is a wonderfully optimistic note to end on. I always ask my guests how they envision the future, and I think you gave a wonderful answer to that. Somebody who's been through a lot of difficulty still maintaining that sense of optimism and hope for the world. Tory, it has been a pleasure having you on Research on Religion.
Thanks so much, Tony.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.